Welcome to the Beer Driven Devs podcast, where your hosts, Matt Goldman and Liam Elliott, share their experiences and passion for technology, software, and of course, beer. So be sure to grab yourselves a cold one and join them for this week's chat.
How you doing, Liam?
Not too bad. I'm bloody tired, actually.
Yeah.
I was, after we said we teed up to do this recording, I was walking to my office, because it's separate from the house, I was going to go via the garage, which is where I store the beers.
Yeah.
I actually looked at it, I'm like, I don't feel like a beer right now. I don't know if I can do one.
Yeah.
What I wanted was a scotch.
Yep.
But I don't have any.
Mm.
So I guess now it's I'm a driven dev.
Yeah.
Neither a beer or a scotch driven dev.
Yeah. I know the feeling. Long weekend?
No, it was too short.
Oh, well, true.
Yeah. Certainly 2 days. Nah, look, just kids' sport. Soccer's over or football, as you would say, is over for this season now. Saturday was last game, which was great. It just feels like just haven't had any time.
Yeah, I know the feeling. Yeah. So Friday night, we went to an open air cinema event at the local community centre.
Yep.
Which we walked down to, and that was after a long day and a long week. And then yesterday we went to the Save the Brumbies rally.
Okay.
And today we went to a birthday party for one of Riley's friends.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like much, but when you think about the fact that we have no cars now.
Yes. Tell us about that. So last episode we recorded was, I think, the day that your car got written off.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's all sorted?
It's sorted in that it is now actually officially written off because that was the day of the accident. So I've got some money now from the insurance company, but they don't make it easy. I mean, I guess nor should they. Well, I don't know. Maybe they should. I don't know. It was unnecessarily painful for reasons that I won't go into. So yeah, so I'm also tired and have been walking a lot and carrying kids and bags and on and off buses. And it's been an exhausting weekend.
Just throw them on the bike.
I was thinking about it.
Is that back on the road?
It is, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I fixed that one myself.
Oh, fun and games, eh? Oh, gosh. So we were tossing up about what we wanted to talk about tonight. And I threw a few ideas out there and you said, no, fuck off. I don't like any of them or something to that effect. And then you threw out a couple. And one was based on an email from 2007 that I actually was never aware of, right?
Yep. Let me backtrack a minute because I just thought of a segue.
Go.
So yes, the bike is back on the road. The bike doesn't have a lithium problem because the bike is petrol engine inline four. Speaking of inline.
Well, there's a segue too.
No, it's not a segue, mate. It's a bike.
It's a bike. Oh, God. Yeah. So it's going to be one of those nights, eh?
Beer-driven dads.
Yeah. So, so in teeing up for this conversation tonight, you suggest we, I guess, review an email from 2007 about inlines, and we're not talking inline fours here. And this is an email I wasn't even aware of.
Mm.
I mean, the sender is someone that we've spoken about in the past.
Yeah.
John Carmack.
Yeah.
And I had a read of it since you sent that through to me, and I've got lots of questions and comments on the email, but I'm curious, like, why now? Why did you bring this up now?
I mean, first of all, I was wondering if you'd ever heard of it before, because I also hadn't. I stumbled across this. How did I even find it? I can't remember. I think I went down the rabbit hole of, okay, I remember, right. So on Friday, I opened a pull request at work internally for an internal repo. It doesn't matter what it is. And I sent a link to the PR to an interested party.
Mm-hmm.
Like someone else at work who is particularly interested in this particular thing. And I just said, I've just done this because I think this would be useful. And he was like, oh yeah, I'll have a look when I get a chance. And then, you know, a couple of hours later, I got a bunch of enthusiastic messages saying, wow, that's clever. And I replied and said, good job, I'm not a Python developer. You remember in Python, that's clever is an insult.
No, didn't know that one.
And we've spoken about this before.
Really?
Yeah. We have. It's one of my favorite things to say. I love that about Python, about the culture that, you know, that's clever is an insult. Like simplicity is the goal. I love that. Anyway, so he also hadn't heard of this. And I was like, okay, well, let me find the reference for that. And I searched, I think, specifically for that, for in Python, that's clever is an insult. And I stumbled across an article on clean code that someone had written and simplicity, and it mentioned this email, and it referred to it as the famous John Carmack email of 2007, and I'd never heard of it. And I haven't done a great deal of research. I did a couple of minutes of looking around and essentially basically trying to find other sources. And there's a couple of copies of it, but there's one that's kind of the canonical one. And I found lots of people referring to it. And I think, like, obviously Carmack is well known for being a game dev.
Yeah.
He talks right off the bat about a non-game use case, although the similarities are quite clear. But yeah, like a lot of people that I saw talking about it are kind of enterprise devs or really from any kind of field. And I thought it was really interesting. And I thought it, in particular, the thought process and really the reasoning. And then when I started evaluating my reaction to it, there's a real socio-technical aspect to this as well that I found interesting. Basically, when I reflected myself and when I really kind of I started thinking about my reaction to it and my analysis of it and the lens through which I looked at it, and it just there was a few interesting threads arising from it, aside from the fact that the email itself and the content itself is worthy of it, like its own discussion.
Oh, 100%. So before we go too much further and lose absolutely everyone about talking about this in a very abstract, vague mechanism, do you want to dig into, I guess, the gist of the email?
Yeah. Okay. So.
Sorry. Or is that the gist? Is it the gist or the gist?
I don't know. We'd have to pray to Jod for an answer.
I'm sure there's a gif around for that.
So the gist of this email is, like, he sent it internally. This was when they were working. I think this is when they're working on Doom 3. Sounds about right. 2007.
No. Well, I saw a follow up email, a reply to this.
I was going to get to that.
And that one mentioned Doom 3. I thought, and that was the one in 2018. I think
2014.
Oh, yeah, 2014. Anyway, it was 2007.
Okay, so the short version is he sent this email around and he said, I would like everyone to start thinking about inlining their functions, right? And basically, that, like, in a nutshell, that's what he said. And he talked through his reasoning and what that means. But basically, what he's saying is, look, you have your code, and without going into the reasoning, we'll dive into the reasoning next, but I just want to set the scene. He was saying he thinks that we should all think about not breaking out code into separate functions and just inlining all the logic.
Can I just jump in for a sec?
Yeah.
I've got it in front of me here, or a version of it in front of me here right now. But my recollection was not just, I think he was using that as an example, but what he was really trying to cover, and my takeaway was what he was trying to cover, was thinking about what you're doing from a stylistic point of view. And to that, I guess that clean code article you saw earlier was, right, and what triggered it for you was, like, let's just think about what we're doing. And this is one example of where the traditional methodology, the traditional way of thinking can be a burden, can introduce bugs. But I don't know. I think I read it more as a stylistic thing from a wholesale point of view, whereas with the inlining of functions as just one very focused example.
Well, that was my interpretation at first as well, and I went back and reread it, and I don't think that was correct.
Okay.
Now, before we dive into that, I want to just touch on the other thing you said, which was the follow-up email from 2014.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think obviously the one from 2007 is a lot longer. The one from 2014 is basically, like, I think, what, three paragraphs?
Yeah.
But there is so much to unpack from that follow-up one. The first thing is, I'm very, very much reading between the lines here. Very, very much reading between the lines. But my takeaway from the 2014 one is that I think he kind of regrets that people misinterpreted his email as saying you should inline your functions, because that wasn't what he was saying. And that's why I said repeatedly, he said, I want you to think about it, right? Yep. Because very, very much it's a question of right tool for the job. And in the original email, he gives an example of a jet fighter control system.
Yes. So
that he was consulting on.
Yep.
And then the other thing that he spoke about was the fact that they're building a game, right? And he was saying we're trying to hit this goal of 60 hertz. And that's also interesting, I think, to talk about how back then that was an aspirational goal, whereas now we consider it the baseline.
Yeah.
And that's a whole other discussion. But, you know, like, so the point is that in both cases he was talking about performance, and it's not just bugs. It's not just bugs that cause errors. It's bugs that impact performance. Like, you've got to have this, like, sub-millisecond decision-making for, you know, a jet fighter that's traveling at Mach 3.
Yep.
And making, you know, delta V calculations. You've got to have that reliability. And any set, you know, that was the comparison he's making to the game. Now, in terms of what you just said about it being stylistic, that was my original interpretation. And I think if you look at it through the lens that I look at it through, and you, my goal, my job is to write code that is going to be maintainable, right?
We've discussed this in the past. That one I do remember.
Yeah.
Yep.
So it's not that performance doesn't matter, although we have spoken about this as well, and performance usually doesn't matter like these days. Not to say you should write inefficient code that's going to clunk along, but you don't need to optimize. Generally, in terms of what we do, we're not optimizing for those sub-millisecond improvements.
But even back in 2007, if you go to that original email,
yeah,
he suggests doing things that are not optimized.
No, he's like, this is the thing, is he actually, it's a different, he's optimizing for something else. That's the whole point.
Well, he's optimizing to minimize bug, but, and I'm thinking about I'm looking at the point, I've just got to, I need to find the exact quote that I'm thinking there, but where he basically says, rather than checking a condition before running a piece of code, run the piece of code, then check the condition as to whether or not you're going to use it.
Yes. Yeah. And yeah, there's a reason he says that. And can I come back to that?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
So the point is, right, the first time I read through it, because he says, like, there's a lot in this email, and that's one of the things he says, right? There's a lot in there. But one of the things he says is it's about misdirection or indirection, because when he was speaking about that other, the other example, and he cited someone else, he was talking about only ever call forward in your code, never call backwards.
Yep.
And when he was speaking about having everything, you know, in line, and like in lining your functions, one of the things he said was like, look, if you're reviewing, if you're trying to find a bug, or you're trying to find where a performance optimization, or where some performance is getting lost, you step through, you read through your function, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you read the first line, then you read the next line, then you read the next line, which is a call to another function, right? And you look at what the function's called, and it's well named, you can understand what it does, you skip ahead to the next line.
Yep.
You skip ahead to the next line, right? And the misdirection there, this is basically the read the script fallacy we were talking about.
Yep.
Right? Because you're not then going off and digging into each of those other individual functions to read what they do and then coming back. There is a counter to that, which is that, well, if you're debugging, you are, because you're stepping into them. But the point that he made, and this was not his main point, and this was what I took away the first time I was reading it, but the point he was making at that specific moment was, if you inline all your functions, it forces you to literally read through every line that's being executed.
Yeah.
And it also forces you to write the code in order. So you read it in order.
Yeah.
Right. And he was talking about this as being a way of eliminating bugs. The problem is, again, like, you're optimizing for a different kind of developer there, right? So someone who's resident in the code, someone who's reading this all day, every day for years and years, that's kind of okay. For someone like you or me, who's a consultant or a contractor, where we're visitors to code, even if it's our own code, you know, we do need to break things up, because we just don't have the context window for it, right? So we need to break things up.
Yeah.
But that was my original takeaway, and it was wrong. That was kind of one of the things he was saying, but that wasn't the main point. The main point was closer to the point that you just raised.
It was closer to the point of not thinking about the optimizations, but thinking about how we can reduce the likelihood of getting bugs through the system.
Yeah. So I'm just trying to think how to tie this together. So one of the points he was trying to make, and this was a major like bombshell moment for me when I started digging to what he was talking about with the 2014 email. So I'm going to take a bit of a detour here. I kind of have this rule, which it's kind of my personal style. I don't know if this is, I think this is a thing that other people do as well, but I don't know. Right. But basically, if you have my rule is this, right? Functions should not mutate state unless that is the sole purpose of the function and it's clearly named as doing so.
Yep.
So if you have a function, as you're going through, it makes a bunch of decisions and does some things and then changes things, and then things come out the other end changed.
100%.
That's opaque, right?
Yep.
Whereas I think if you are stepping through and you make a decision and you want to change the state, call a function that changes the state, right?
Yeah. That's going way, 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 way back. I remember being on a team where one of the other juniors, and I'm pretty sure it wasn't me, but you know, it might well have been, got completely roasted by the tech lead because inside property getters, things were being set.
Yeah, that's bad. Right? Yeah.
And like it's something that stuck with me pretty much ever since seeing that roasting. Was like, you know, principle of least surprise. If I'm calling get, don't set something.
Yeah.
Right. And if it's, you know, you can't, like, it seems obvious, but a more modern incarnation of that is REST APIs, when people do a GET request and it mutates state on the server.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
People, it still happens. People just don't quite see it that way. And that's why I think we had this conversation not long after you started, after I met you, we had a very similar conversation about this.
Yeah.
And I think I was losing my brain at the time, because someone was doing a post to fetch data, or doing a GET. They were doing it was in the wrong way. And I'm like, you can't, because if I call a GET, I expect the server state to be exactly the same.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, the state of the resource to be the same.
Yes.
To be technical.
Yes.
And then that's where you go down that path, and that's where it starts to get a bit hairy. But yeah, I guess that little aside, I've seen it happen. I've seen what happens if you don't follow that rule.
Yeah. Well, it's not that much of an aside, right? So first of all, it's not a concrete rule. It's kind of a style, right? But it should be a concrete rule. Now, just to jump ahead a long way, and then we'll come back. The thing that he said in the 2014 email, because he wasn't backtracking on the 2007.
Oh, no.
He was kind of saying, he said a few things, but, you know, as I said, my reading between the lines was, I think people have got this wrong by thinking that I'm saying this is what you should just do universally, which is not what I was saying at all. I was saying, think about it, which is kind of going back to what you were saying. But the other thing that he said, which was the bombshell for me, was he said, functional programming solves this problem a lot more elegantly. And that's when I started looking into a bit, because I've looked into functional programming before. Yep. I don't really know enough about it, but I started looking into it a bit more. And yeah, like the process that the approach that we just described is canonically functional programming. Like in functional programming, everything's a pure function.
Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting. Anyway, so back to 2007, just jumping back and forth and what you were saying, right? And so, okay, so he's saying inline all your functions, read through, it forces you to step through. And what I was saying was about the side effects of mutating state, right? So mm-hmm. anything that changes state should be explicitly a state changing function. Now, what he said, which was really interesting, and this is what you were getting to, was about the conditional state change, right?
Yes.
He said the problem with the indirection and the misdirection is that if you evaluate a condition and make a decision whether or not to change state, something else later that depends on that change state that you don't expect may not work as expected.
I think it goes even deeper than that.
Yeah.
It's, well, the way I read it was, if that function that you have skipped over mutates state in a way that you were not expecting it to.
Yeah.
Right. You might expect it to have come out with a different result and actually mutate a piece of state.
Yeah.
But it might have done something that you weren't expecting it to have done. And that's the critical part.
You actually needed it to do.
The critical part is, if you have that if condition and you don't step over it, what you expected didn't happen, and that's fine. But where the bug creeps in is when there's something that you weren't expecting that didn't happen that should have happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So what he said is that, and again, he didn't, again, like, and I'm being careful to say this because he was careful to say this as well. And reading on his 2014 email, it seems that he doesn't feel that people were careful to read it. But he said, what you should think about, and again, he wasn't saying do this. He said, what you should think about is, don't condition on the change of state, condition on the result, right?
Yes.
Or branch and result. So never skip over the state change, do the state change. But then if your condition says you don't need it, then just ignore it.
Yeah.
Because then anything that depends on it that you weren't aware of is still good to go.
Yeah. And sorry, I've got nothing to add to that. I'm thinking other things too already.
How do you feel about that?
My gut instinct, as soon as I started reading that paragraph, I was like, that goes against everything that you've ever been taught.
Yeah. Right?
You branch at the start.
Well,
right, you branch, like, as an optimization, I don't want to run code that I know I don't need to run.
Well, this is what's interesting, and because this is what you were saying when we were talking about what he's optimizing for. What was interesting was that he was saying, look, the penalty, the optimization penalty of running that code is nothing. Like,
this was the point I was trying to make earlier. Like, yes, he is trying to optimize to get these 60 hertz frame rates, And yes, he's in a highly, like we've spoken about some of the other optimizations he's made to actually get Doom running back when it shouldn't have run, but yet he is still willing to run code that doesn't need to be run.
Yes.
So those optimizations, maybe they're not required.
I think my interpretation here is that what he's saying is that the optimization that you lose through the unexpected state changes or unexpected loss of state changes is far greater than the optimization you lose through running that code that you may not need to run.
Yeah, agreed. And I just found it, like I said, like my first instinct was, wow, that just goes against everything I've ever been taught, never thought, but I kind of get it.
Yeah. So I think, so there's two things here, right? So there's two principles that are competing, and I'm having some cognitive dissonance here, just like you from the sound of it. On the one hand, I don't like it because it feels to me like, and again, my main point through all of this is going to be his point, which is think about it and think about whether it's relevant to you or not. Yeah. And we're working in different domains with different constraints and different requirements. And I think, again, looking at his 2014 email, and again, very much reading between the lines because he doesn't actually say this, but it seems like there was misinterpretation and that he felt that people had blindly applied what he was saying. But the point that I'm making here is, to me, it feels wrong. Like I think the problem is not to, the solution is not to just execute everything because you don't know what's going to happen. The solution is, if something's on the critical path, put it on the critical path.
Yep. Agreed.
Don't have it in an if or an else.
Well, yeah, I know. I think it goes further than that too, right? There's a section where he's talking about cutting and pasting code.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm scrolling through to find the exact one I was just looking at. Right. And to quote the email, it says, for instance, having one check in the player think, I think there's a typo there, but having one check in the player think code for health is less than or equal to zero and they're not killed is almost certain to spawn less bugs than having a killed player method called in 20 different places.
Yeah.
Right. We are trained to say, I can see that pattern of the health check and are they alive or not? And then either killing them or doing what needs to happen. Like we're trained to just extract method so you can call that from multiple different places. What he's saying is you could do that, but there is a chance that you're hiding a bug. Whereas if it was completely in line and that check was done in line and you can see exactly what's happening as you're stepping through it, you're going to introduce far fewer bugs.
Right. So I'm not 100% clear on the logic behind why that's the case, but let me just clarify something here. So when we talk about a game and this function, this hypothetical function that we're talking about is not hypothetical. We're talking about the core loop, right? So in a game, you have the core loop, call it main, whatever it's not, but like call it main. And the point is that this, all of this code executes once per frame.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So what he's saying makes sense in that context. He is saying evaluate the state, the entire state, once per frame, and then render accordingly, update the screen according to the whole state. What he's saying is don't branch on whether or not you should evaluate state, branch on whether or not you should render or what you should render. And I think if you think about it from that perspective, it makes more sense. And I obviously recognize I'm transposing to our domain here.
Yeah.
But like, how else can we comprehend it? And I think because what I said earlier was that there's two aspects to it, right? And one was the thing that I described. And the second one is what you started to and what I'm leaning towards now, which is his main point, which is that it's about consistent execution.
Yeah.
He doesn't want any surprises every frame. He wants all his expectations met. He doesn't want any surprises. Every frame should execute exactly the same as every other frame. What's different is the output.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Agreed. But, you know, the way that you articulated that just then makes me think it's not too far off from our current, the domains that we work in at the moment.
Yeah.
Now, you were saying like the core game loop, the whole purpose of the core game loop is to determine what is to render the next frame.
Yeah.
Right?
I know exactly where you're going with this.
It is to manipulate state so that when it comes time to rendering the next frame, that state can be rendered on screen.
Yeah.
Is that not what a view model does?
It's what a view model does. It's arguably what the Elm architecture and its variants do. If we step back a layer into the abstract from a conceptual level, and then just drill down into the concrete in another place. It's an aggregate route.
I'm struggling to draw that bow, but
very, very abstract, right? The point is, it's about ensuring that the entire state is consistent and evaluated as expected.
Yeah, which I guess is what an aggregate route is responsible for. Absolutely. So it's not that, if you think about it in that respect, it's not that dissimilar. It's just the fact that it happens 60 times a second.
Well, it's not even that, right? I mean, that there is that, but it's also like, you've got to think about it. Like, and this is what he said, right? It is what he's saying. If you think about what he's saying and you think about what he's saying conceptually, which is what we've just done, like we've just dissected it and we've just tried to understand what is he actually saying here? Because what he's not saying is inline all your functions, like write one massive long function and put everything in there. He's saying, this is why you might do that. And the conceptual reasoning behind it applies differently in different domains and different contexts. Yeah. It's horses for courses. That's the point, right? He's not saying this is the rule, do this everywhere without exception. He's saying this is the goal that I'm achieving here and this is how I'm trying to achieve it. And if we say, well, actually, we're trying to achieve the same goal, we just do it in different ways.
And you know what? Like, it's one of those things that I think our industry is quite guilty of doing.
Yeah.
He's saying, this is the way to do things. So, and then everyone seems to just go, oh, well, someone, so-and-so said, this is how it should be done. So I'm going to do it and I'm not going to think about why, right? Look at design patterns, any design pattern, TDD, DDD, Redux patterns, right? MVVM, like any of those patterns, any design pattern. Right. Someone says, I think this is how it should be done. And then, yes, you get people that just jump on board and say everything has to be done in that fashion.
Yeah. There's a quote from a book that you might appreciate. I'll find it. I can remember the line, but I'll get you the book and the page number later. We can put it in the show notes. But, and it's blind adherence to any pattern is an anti-pattern.
Yeah, I think so. Right. You do. And I think that's where it is. Like, you need to use the best of your experience, the best of your knowledge. Knowing what works for your exact problem right here, right now, is going to be the best thing to be using at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, this is the thing, is we as a profession can have a tendency to be quite dogmatic.
Well, actually, so yes, 100%. Sorry, I was just reading his 2014 email, right?
Yeah.
To make it just the last line on it, to make things more complicated, the do always then inhibit or ignore strategy, while a very good idea for high reliability systems, is less appropriate in power and thermal constrained environments like mobile, which is what we're saying there, right?
Yeah.
You understand your environment. You understand what you're working on. So maybe my strategies are not 100% appropriate for you right here, right now.
Yeah, that's the point. That's exactly the point.
Oh, okay, great. Done. And you got anything else to add then?
No, I think that's it for this episode.
What's
also interesting is, like, I guess we don't have visibility into the internals of id software,
mm-hmm.
but it does seem like the 2014 email was, as I said, reading between the lines, but it does feel like it's him saying, everyone kind of interpreted this as me saying, this is what you should always do. And that isn't what I meant. And what's interesting is if I read the kind of meta information about it, like what people have said about it, most of it seems to land where we've landed. And I don't know if that's like it's been retroactively edited based on 2014. Yeah. But I didn't find a lot of people saying Carmack said this, therefore just do it.
So I was going to say this towards the end. But like you said, I think it's quite telling about the inner workings of id Software.
Yeah.
Right. The way he finishes and closes out that original 2007 email.
Yeah.
I thought it was brilliant.
Right.
I think it was probably one of the best finishes, the best closing to any email like this.
Yeah.
Simply with one word, discussion, ?
Yeah, that was brilliant. I have to say, I did enjoy that. Yes, that was great.
Basically, and I think that's where it comes down to, that sort of says, here is my opinion. Let's open the floor. Right. Yes, clearly he is well respected in the organization and he's well respected in the industry.
Yeah.
But he still goes out there and says, okay, here's my opinion. Here's my justification for it. Let's have an open discussion about it.
Yeah. Although I would argue that he wasn't even saying, here's my opinion. It was like, here's a thought I had.
Yeah.
Let's chat up. And I want, there's a whole other discussion here to have around perception and power dynamics. It may be, and again, I don't really know the inner workings of id or the culture, but it may be that, you know, he kind of thinks that inviting discussion like that is inviting discussion, completely naive to the fact that the power dynamic and power imbalance between him and everyone else at id may mean that when he says something like that, it's just taken as
100%. Look, I've worked for people who don't understand those power dynamics.
Yeah.
Right. Who don't understand that when they say something or put something in an email, that they don't realize that, or in their head, they think they're asking a question or they're making a suggestion.
Yeah.
But because of the power dynamics, it actually becomes an order.
Yes.
Or they're telling you to do something. Absolutely. Yeah. And like, I, you know, I was in a position where I actually told said person, like, I just, in a candid conversation, but just sort of said, you know, when you sent that email, I know that you intended it to be more of a question, but it came across more as more of an authoritative, like,
this instruction.
Yeah. Exactly. So, absolutely happens in a lot of organizations.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I love that. And just a very simple discussion question mark, John Carmack.
Yeah. I did love that.
So one question I wanted to ask.
Yeah.
Right. One thing I was thinking about when I was reading through this email, both the 07 and the 14 email, a shitload has happened since then.
Yeah.
To put it bluntly, right? What's that? Yeah. 19 years ago.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Do the maths. Let's.
I'm trying not to.
I know. 19 years ago. Not least of which is the advancement in IDEs and tooling available. And I'm not even talking about AI tooling and any of the shit that's around now.
Yeah.
Right. Whereby tracing function calls, static analysis, debugging, like everything is so much easier and so much more convenient now than it was back in 07.
Yeah.
I would be really interested to see how the thought process goes right now, knowing what our current tooling allows in the way of, you know, managing that state and keeping an eye on it, and in the debugging process and managing your work environment and how you've got your IDEs set up and all of that, right?
Yeah.
Does he still feel that the limitations of the mechanisms that he's trying to avoid that introduce said bug, like, are they still so much of a concern now?
I mean, this is something that we've touched on, and this is something that definitely segues to a future topic, but it goes into a broader discussion about the state of the AAA games industry.
Mm-hmm.
This is a whole big discussion, but gamers are furious with the, you know, the AAA gaming studios for the fact that they don't optimize anymore.
Yeah.
So no is the short answer. Like, developers, and we've said this actually about ourselves as well, and it's very much true of our industry as it is of gaming, but developers have outsourced efficiency and optimization to hardware.
Yeah. Well, I mean, who cares if my application's several hundred megs, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, this is the thing, is like, gamers do care that their game download is like, you know, however many hundreds of gigs.
Yeah. I mean,
especially like when it's, you know, you buy it and day one, you can't play it without downloading like a 100 gig patch. Like, yeah, gamers are not happy about that.
Exactly. Like, just to show age and whatnot. I just remember as a kid when we got our first 286, I think it was, that had like a 300 meg hard drive.
Yeah.
It was massive. Right. And now you barely get away with writing a console application that scrapes in under 300 meg.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just a quick one, because I found the quote.
Yeah.
It's this book, page 266. Of course, blind adherence to any pattern is an anti-pattern. You should prioritize ensuring that your code is readable and maintainable. That is page 266, chapter 9 of .NET MAUI in Action, Matt Goldman, 2023.
I haven't read that. Is that one the one that was on the bestsellers list?
No.
No.
No. Oh. It's the one that was in the bargain bin. No. Oh. It's the one that would be in the bargain bin if they printed books and sold them in bookshops anymore.
Oh, yes. Well,
so yeah, sorry, bit of a detour with the book citation there. But yeah, I mean, look, this is something we've spoken about before, and as I said, it's not just gaming. It's we do it. It is particularly problematic in gaming. But, you know, on the other hand, like, you know, the reasoning holds. If you don't need to, if the hardware does it, what's the incentive? Like, what's the motivation to eke out those extra bits of performance? And something else we've spoken about before as well is there are people that genuinely just love that, and there are people that do it. But you've got to think about, where's the most important time? Where's the most valuable piece of work for you to invest your limited budget of time?
Yeah, I get it. But I don't know. I just still feel some of the things that he says in that email still challenge me in ways that I'm still not sure I fully agree with.
Yeah.
And I'm still trying to get my head around them. And like the one part where he's talking about rather than extracting the function out, he'd rather see the inline function with a big comment around it telling you what it does.
Yeah.
Right. Using large comment blocks inside the major function to delimit the minor functions is a good idea for quick scanning. I still get, like, that still does my head in. Like, I've always, again, I'm always of the opinion that if I'm going to comment something, I'm going to comment why it was there, not what it's actually doing.
Yeah.
Because the what is really generally covered by the function name that you're about to call or the variable names.
But this, yes, but that's predicated on something I said earlier, which is having well-named functions.
Correct. But if we're removing those, then we're replacing those with large comment blocks. So I'd kind of, that one really threw me a bit, and I'm still trying to get my head around that. But he does say, like, with, you know, editor collapsing of sections too can help strip those down. But one thing he was also talking about in there too with functions is about something calling a function it should not have been allowed to call.
Yep.
Right.
This is an interesting one. Yeah. Right.
Because he's in the C++ environment, which I guess in the world of .NET work that we're in, we actually have protections against that. Right. I can have a protected method or a protected class.
Yep.
I can have an internal method, right? Or an internal class, right? So we can be sure, like, we can really restrict the visibility.
We've got accessibility modifiers.
Yeah, that's the word. That's what I was after, yeah. Right? So I don't know if that argument is as strong, given, again, our tool set. Like, if we're in the world of C, I'm sure that's different. But given our tool set, I'm not sure if that argument holds as much, provided you're not the kind of person that makes everything public.
Yeah, well, sure. Yes. Look, again, like, I think on the one hand, on surface value, it's impossible to disagree with you because you are very obviously correct. But I think if we look at it from the perspective of conceptually, like, if we can try and say, okay, well, that doesn't apply, that doesn't make sense, but what is the goal? What is he actually trying to achieve here? And does that make sense? And I think it does. And I think we've just got other ways of doing it.
Yeah.
And if you look at his 2014 email, even he said functional programming achieves this much more elegantly.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know, like, just again, like, tying back to what the point you were making earlier about how, you know, people just read things and think, well, that's the advice, I'll just follow it. Or kind of the dogmatic nature of our profession. That's exactly the problem. It is, you know, if, like, someone said, oh, you know, here's something that I found doing that works, and, you know, people just blindly just then follow and apply it.
But it's not even that. It's not, I found this and it looks like it works. It's Facebook do it this way, so I must do it this way.
Yeah.
Netflix uses microservices, so we must use microservices.
Yeah.
Facebook use the Redux pattern, so we have to use that Redux pattern.
Yeah.
Right. Solving problems that they had to go out of their way to solve because they had those problems.
They went out of their way to create in the first place, yeah.
Well, but, I mean, they are their problem. And then people look at it and go, well, that's the technology, that's the techniques, that's the patterns that they use, without actually figuring out, do we have the same problems that they have?
But even then, like, I mean, it is that. But then that's the first question, right, is do we have this problem? And if the answer is yes, that doesn't immediately mean, is this the right solution?
Oh, I've got a whole rant on that one. I think I'd love that. I love that one. I've got a whole rant on problem solving.
Yeah. Oh, man. Like, I, you know, having worked in support, the number of times I've come in mid-crisis and, you know, said, why the heck is this server rebooting? And, you know, a junior has said, I rebooted it because when this happened last week, we rebooted this server and that fixed the problem.
Yeah.
And it's like,
yeah, but did you take into account that was under these circumstances and this was going on, and oh, and by the way, there's this critical job that's happening on that server right now that wasn't happening last week,
and a whole other department is critically dependent on that being available.
Yeah,
and, you know, the reboot was for a specific reason that isn't required right now. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No. Anyway, maybe that's a discussion for next week.
Yeah. I know you're keen to talk about problem solving.
Absolutely. And you know what my biggest problem right now is?
It's you regret past my not bedtime. Getting a beer in the way in?
Oh, I don't have a beer to start with, but it's past my bedtime.
Yeah.
Well, Matt, that was a great journey down the last 19 years of the industry. I think I've learned a lot. And I absolutely, like I said, it triggered something, but in a good way. It made me think.
And that's what he wanted.
Yeah. And I think that's the purpose of this conversation today, right?
I think so too. And I would also say, like, obviously we'll make sure that the link is in the notes, but we've barely scratched the surface. Like, there is so much to unpack across these two emails, so much to explore and think about and discuss. If anyone wants to chat to us about any of this, I would welcome that. But yeah, I would very much encourage everyone to have a read, because it's just a really interesting read, even if you don't kind of dissect it. But I think you would find it hard not to.
Yep, absolutely. Okay, man, I think that's it for this episode of the Beer Driven Derbs. I'm Liam Elliott.
I'm Matt Goldman.
Cheers.
Cheers.
The Beer Driven Devs podcast is recorded and produced on Dharawal and Darkinjung land.
I got a good title for that episode when we do it, Liam. It's just too long, which is Beer, the Solution to and Cause of All of Life's Problems.
I got lots of problems. I just need help solving them all.